This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. More than 190 million Americans are overweight. It's about two-thirds of the American population, and almost half of them are considered obese. It is an alarming statistic and one that has health care officials determined to reduce that number. Potential solutions are complicated by the many psychological, environmental, and genetic causes. Joining us now by phone to talk about obesity and its causes is Sarah Armstrong. She's general pediatrician at the Duke Children's Healthy Lifestyles Program. Welcome, Sarah. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
Taking your calls and emails as well. Do you have an experience with obesity or questions about obesity and weight? Give us a call, 877-962-9862, or send us an email at sot@wunc.org. Sarah, how do you define obesity?
Well, I treat exclusively children, and the definition of obesity in children and adults is slightly different. So adults, as much as we might wish to be getting taller, most of us are not. So it's a static number. So a body mass index, which is a ratio of weight to height of 25 or greater, is considered overweight, and then 30 or greater is considered obese.
And
in children,
go ahead.
In children, that varies slightly because it varies by age. So a four-year-old would have a healthy BMI in the 18 range, whereas a teenager would approach more that 25 of an adult. So it varies by age. So we define it as being overweight is greater than the 85th percentile for the child's age and gender, and obese being greater than the 95th percentile.
And is the difference between obesity and overweight simply where you are on the spectrum, or is there something else that distinguishes obesity?
Well, the definitions really are purely based on the numbers. The implication of obesity and overweight has a much more long-lasting sort of health implication. So what we know is that children with a body mass index over 85th percentile, many of them won't have any markers of disease currently. But when you get to children with a body mass index over the 95th percentile, or another way of saying that is of 100 children of their age and gender, they have a higher BMI than 95 of them. They often have one or two cardiovascular risk factors already, meaning high blood pressure or early signs of diabetes in childhood.
And do we know which came first? Is one a cause of the other?
It's kind of the nature-nurture question, isn't it? It's a question that's often asked. There's certainly contributions by both. And I think a lot of the evidence so far has been focused on what we have choice over and what is our personal control over what we eat and how active we are. And a lot of scientific research has been focused on trying to identify that smoking gun or that one gene, you know, that if only we knew about it, maybe we could do something to help people. But the truth is that this is really a complex interaction between genes and hormones and brain biology and the environment, and certainly a certain degree of personal choice as well. So there's many things that are at play here.
What are some of the other health risks that being overweight or being obese that we would face?
Well, there's a whole list of them, and for adults, I think is where we most commonly think of diabetes and high blood pressure, high cholesterol. Liver disease is one that's more emerging, a condition called non-alcoholic steatohepatitis or fatty liver disease is more and more common. It's actually present in one of three obese adults. Long-term, it leads to liver cirrhosis or failure and requires a liver transplant. So this is a new and emerging disease that has a lot of health officials concerned. There are also orthopedic problems such as bowing of the knees that could require surgery and psychosocial problems. So, for example, even in childhood, children who are obese compared with children who are living with cancer have a lower measured quality of life. So they're teased, they're bullied, they're often marginalized by their peers. And unlike other diseases where there's some sympathy involved, many times, I think unfairly, obese children are blamed for their own disease, and many are perceived as lazy or lacking willpower.
But as you suggest, there are so many factors that contribute to the cause that this would also not only complicate things psychologically for individuals, but for practitioners and for the health industry, it makes it difficult to come up with treatments and remedies. Isn't that right?
That is correct. And, you know, here's the interesting thing. Any theory of why we have so many obese American children and adults currently has got to explain this fact. So The prevalence of obesity in children aged 0 to 6 months has doubled in the past 20 years. So this is a group of children that are not really eating at McDonald's much, and they weren't a big group of exercisers to begin with. So there has got to be something else at play here besides just our own personal choices.
But that raises another interesting question for me, and that is, can you be obese as an infant in ages 0 to 6 months?
There are new definitions that look at weight and length, and greater than the 95th percentile is considered obese as an infant. And it's an important area to consider. You know, we often think of obesity at the age where you do make personal choice, but we're learning more and more that the mom's pre-pregnancy weight, her health behaviors during pregnancy, the child's birth weight, so low birth weight or high birth weight, and the rate of growth in that first precious few weeks of life, all are independent predictors of obesity later in life. So there's a lot going on in that in utero environment and even sort of in the pre-programming setting the stage environment.
And are you finding that those children in that 95th and above percentile actually go on to be, are more likely to go on to be overweight or obese?
That's correct.
Yeah, so that's the real indication. It's not sort of where you are at the moment, but the fact is it's a good indicator that this might be a problem later on.
Yes, correct.
And epigenetics is also an emerging field of study. Tell us about that and what implications it has.
Sure. Well, this isn't my personal area of research. As a clinician, I interpret the science for patients and families. So genetics is the study of the actual gene, and the genes encode essentially everything that makes us us, our hair color, our skin, our nails, all of that. And they do that by translating these little tiny codes into proteins that kind of do the work of making us who we are. That changes very slowly. So that's when we talk about evolution and genes changing over generations and generations. So thinking that maybe our gene pool has changed causing the epidemic is maybe a less likely explanation, since the epidemic has really just occurred over the last 20 to 30 years. Epigenetics is the study of factors that alter that gene's expression. Without changing the DNA strand itself, it can actually change the translation of the DNA into different types of proteins. So in mice, for example, a epigenetic impact can change the mouse's coat from white to yellow. So it can be a very noticeable difference. And again, it's not changing the DNA strand itself, but it's changing how it's expressed.
So rather than inheriting the gene for yellow fur, this thing decided the gene changed the fur on the animal itself.
That's
it's not
correct.
Something that inherited. And
that's
it may be
correct.
A response to something in the, and it most probably is a response to something in the environment. Mm.
So, yes, and this is where the very kind of exciting new field of research is, right at that interaction between the gene and the environment. So in this one study that's really a landmark study done by Randy Jertl here at Duke and his colleagues, they exposed pregnant mice to a chemical substance called BPA, many people have heard of, bisphenol A, which is a plasticizer that's used in water bottles, and it's used in the plastic that coats the inside of soup cans, metal cans, to prevent the soup from touching the metal.
Mm-hmm.
It's in our food supply, and when you test Americans' urine, you see that most of us have it in us at some point. The stuff is even in baby bottles. So it's all throughout the environment. And when these pregnant mice were exposed to BPA, then their offspring changed the color of their coat and became obese. So there are some very real effects of a whole host of compounds in our environment that could cause an alteration of how our DNA is expressed that's passed on to our children.
We talked about the raw numbers, 190 million people overweight and about, I think, 70, 75 million obese. How has that changed over time? How quickly are the numbers rising?
Well, when you look back, you know, we've only been collecting data for so long, so it's hard to tell once you go back much earlier than the 70s. But if you look back at other different sources of data, it looks like there's actually been an increase in the rates of the average weights of Americans probably since the beginning of the century. But really, it's been over the past 20 or 30 years that things have just accelerated much faster. And that's across all age groups, all ethnicities, all socioeconomic categories.
And what are our best guesses at this point? We've established, I think, it's a pretty complicated network of factors that go into obesity. But what are our guesses about what's causing this particular epidemic?
Well, it's interesting. There's one of my colleagues in David Katz, who's up at Yale, who often says that we're kind of like polar bears that are living in the Sahara Desert. So, you know, we're genetically designed for a certain environment, and that environment has just changed so rapidly. I mean, think about, you know, when you were going to school, what kinds of things you didn't have that we just take for granted now. You know, the environment has changed faster than any of us can imagine, and we're just not adapted for it. So we're used to having calories being hard to find and physical activity being just a way of life, and it's flipped. Calories are easy to find, and you have to work to find some physical activity in your day.
So that taste we've evolved for fat and salt and sugar, all of which would have served us well if it was hard to find, doesn't
that's
do so
correct.
Well.
Yep, that's exactly difficult. Right. It's called the thrifty genotype theory. That we're thrifty and keeping on calories even when it's to our own detriment.
Talking today about obesity and overweight, Sarah Armstrong is with us, general pediatrician at Duke's Children Healthy Lifestyles Program, taking your phone calls today as well. 877-962-9862 as our conversation continues about the role of depression and addiction in obesity. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today, talking about obesity, its causes, and what can be done to prevent it. Sarah Armstrong is with us on the phone, general pediatrician at Duke Children's Healthy Lifestyles Program. Also joining us now by phone is Bernard Femler. He's an assistant professor of community and family medicine at Duke University. And in our studio is Justin Trogdon. He's a research economist at RTI International. Bernard and Justin, welcome. Good to have you on the program. Nice to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
And we're taking your phone calls and emails as well, 877-962-9862, sot@wunc.org. Bernard, what is the approach in the research community in terms of tackling obesity?
Well, you know, the research community is very engaged in trying to understand, you know, the etiology. What's happening? Why are we seeing this change on one side of the coin? Because if we can figure out what may be some of the sort of driving factors or the contributing factors, we may be able to sort of improve the way in which we develop treatments for individuals who are obese.
And Justin, you know, you heard Sarah just a minute ago talk about the fact that we've evolved for one environment, things have changed, calories are more easy to come by. So that kind of explains genetically perhaps what's going on. But otherwise, what else in terms of the way we're living, what are some of the other guesses about what we're doing that are causing this and that might lead to some changes?
Economists tend to focus on things like prices and incomes. And one of the things we've noticed over the past 20, 30 years, as Sarah alluded to, is that calories are not only accessible, but they're cheap. And in fact, high-calorie, low-nutrient foods are actually relatively cheaper now than they were 20 or 30 years ago. So if you think about what people are eating, and from an economic standpoint, price tends to matter – fruits and vegetables are actually becoming relatively more expensive, and so we're seeing a lot more consumption of prepackaged processed foods that tend to be high in calories.
Does that suggest that there is some kind of economic or perhaps public policy attack that we could or approach that we might be taking?
Yeah, there's actually a lot of interest in the obesity research around economics now in using price incentives to help guide behavior. It's something that will kind of affect the entire environment at once. And I think a lot of obesity researchers have seen the success that tobacco has had with increasing tax rates on cigarettes. So there are several ways you can think about making healthy foods relatively more affordable. And the idea is hopefully that people will then start switching back to more fruits and vegetables.
And we've seen some examples of this. I think in New York City, they're talking about at least considering taxing high sugar snacks and drinks and that sort of thing.
Yes. Politically, often a difficult thing to do, but the intuition is what we just described. There are other efforts as well. New York has also proposed to restrict what people can use food stamps to purchase, what types of actually sort of junk foods they're not allowed to purchase. There are other programs where people are trying to get farmers markets to accept food stamps, which would allow, again, sort of affordable access to fruits and vegetables where it wasn't before.
And Bernard, this is sort of the, you know, Justin's talking about the economic view and some of the factors involved here, also some psychological factors involved. You've done research into the ties between depression and obesity. What have you discovered?
Well, what we've been trying to understand is, you know, how some psychological symptoms may overlap with obesity, and depression seems to have some things in common with obesity. The you know, there are different types of depressive symptoms that are characterized by sort of having low energy and consuming more than one would normally consume. So you know, these kind of symptoms of depression also seem to sort of overlap with, you know, what we suspect would be causes of obesity. So it's been difficult to try to understand, you know, does depressive symptoms cause obesity, or does obesity sort of lead to depressive symptoms? And all we can really say is that there seems to be some sort of overlapping systems at the neurological level, but we don't really know exactly how those are interconnected.
Well, Sarah, when you work with children, do you see evidence of a tie between depression or addiction? We haven't talked about that yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly. We know that there's a higher rate of depression in kids who are overweight than their normal weight peer counterparts. The other thing that I just wanted to tag on to what Justin said earlier, though, about the pricing of foods, is that the one other thing that drives the type of foods that people purchase is the media. And we know that, you know, marketing budgets for these big companies are big budgets. I think Coca-Cola has $1 billion a year marketing budget, and Pepsi might have, you know, almost $2 billion, I think it was. You know, children, because I treat children, 8 and under, can't tell the difference between regular programming and advertising that's targeted at them. So in many countries recognizing this, in the UK, advertising directly to children under 12 is illegal. We don't have any restrictions like that in the United States, which is why you see, you know, cereal boxes with colorful characters that clearly are not targeted towards the parents. They're targeted towards the toddler to capture their attention and make them want to, you know, tug their mom's sleeve until she buys that one for them. So I think that's one other driver that we need to consider when you're talking about policy changes of people's food choices.
It is amazing, too, to think that if you add it up, that's $3 billion spent on convincing us to drink sugar water, something that I think we could do all by ourselves without persuasion. And yet, of course, it obviously has an influence, and that's important. So it really does kind of put things in perspective. And also the subsidies. A lot of that soda is sweetened with corn sweetener, which is subsidized. So in other words, taxpayers are paying for an artificially sweet deal, frankly, for corn producers that allows them to put corn sweetener in the sodas. Soybean oil ends up in a lot of our products as filler because it's cheaper than it should be because of federal subsidies. That's all part of the picture.
That's correct. And it ends up in products that it didn't used to, such as bread, you know, so it doesn't usually have sweetener in it.
877-962-9862 if you want to join our conversation about obesity today. Heather is on the line from Cary. Hello, Heather.
Hi, how are you today, Frank?
Good.
I am the mother of two premature infants. They were born 2 months early, and this question's for Sarah. She had talked about obesity in children 0 to 6 months. Are there different standards for premature infants? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Heather. Sarah?
Yes.
Are there different standards for premature infants?
It's a very good question. And what we know is that children who are born small for their gestational age, which most preemies are initially at higher risk for developing obesity later in life. But what we also know is there's some good news to that, too, is that it seems to be more dependent on their rate of weight gain in those early first years than it is on the absolute weight. So what we encourage parents of underweight infants to do is to keep them healthy by feeding them when they're hungry, but not to overfeed them, which I think is a lot of our tendency, is to try and get them to quote-unquote catch up just as quickly as they can. And maybe we ought to give these babies just a little bit more time to do it kind of on their own schedule.
Well, and as long as we're on that subject, there are changes, too, in our metabolism as we develop. And you have some suggestions about that, particularly as children move into when they start to get a little bit older and maybe get a little more fussy about their diet.
That's correct. There are these interesting sort of periods in a child's development where there seem to be at higher risk during these windows of opportunity for being obese. And, you know, one of those windows is the one we just described, that sort of very first few weeks, first few months of life, when kids are learning how to eat when they're hungry and stop when they're full, which is a life skill many of us still haven't learned.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's also another window kind of right around age 4 to 5. And if you look at a BMI curve for a child, then it looks almost like a check mark. And the top of that check mark is right around age 2, where the BMI curve starts. When you think of toddlers and all their lovely little chubbiness that they have. And then as the check mark sort of comes down and you approach age 4 to 5, you can picture those kindergartners that look like skin and bones for the most part, or they're supposed to at that time anyway. And a lot of them are very picky and they don't want to eat. And maybe they just want to eat a couple bites of something, or they like it at one meal and then they don't want to touch it at the next meal. So this is normal eating behavior for that age. And they are supposed to be picky and their body mass index is supposed to come down. Unfortunately, what happens is, you know, as a parent, and I'm a parent of 3, so I know this, is that, you know, that worries parents when their kids don't want to eat. And our inclination is to, you know, we'll just get them something, you know, whether it's a bowl of macaroni and cheese or whatever, just get them something. And what is happening to many kids, because it is so easy to just get them something, is they're missing the bottom of that check mark and they're kind of sailing right on over it. And what we call that is early adiposity rebound, and it puts you at high risk for being obese as a teenager and then later in life.
So you're sort of training the child to eat more than they really want to, and then they get to beyond the age where they're burning calories quickly, and now we're in trouble.
That is a beautiful way of putting it. That's right.
877-962-9862 if you want to join our conversation on the state of things today, as Joanne has done from Raleigh. Hello, Joanne.
Hi, how are you today?
Good.
I work in pediatric nutrition, and I take my children to Wake County Public Schools, and I am absolutely amazed by the lack of quality of nutritional support, either through the free and reduced lunch or breakfast programs, the products that the schools try to sell in order to make money, and also the promotion of the Pink Box Top program. And the Pink Box Top program is a promotion to get kids to get their parents to buy products such as Pop-Tarts.
Where does that who's behind that program? Where does that come from?
I don't know if it's a Wake County school program, but I was actually on an airplane, and the gentleman who coordinated that program, I think it whether through Kellogg's or General Mills, was telling me about the marketing behind it, and I almost wanted to throw him out of the plane because I'm telling him you're marketing junk children. So,
but it comes to the
schools.
Well, thank you, Joanne, for that. Let me ask Justin about that. School lunch seems to be a good place where you can attack it from a policy point of view.
Yeah, and I think schools in general are a real, I don't want to say battleground, but it's a foreground of policy research around obesity right now, partly because you have a population that is sort of well-defined and you're providing the food for them. And so I know some of the work that we've done with CDC, they're looking at things about reformulating school menus, requirements or whether or not they allow outside vendors in to sell some of the snack items that often the kids choose instead of, you know, the cafeteria lunch. So it is an area that public health policy folks are really very interested in.
Certainly you can look at what kind of promotions they can run through the school system. That would be somewhere where you could look. Bernard, we haven't talked about addiction yet and the correlation there between addiction and obesity. Tell us what you know about that.
Well, just as you mentioned earlier, you shouldn't have to market sugary drinks to people because it's something people would naturally consume, and that's correct. People, those sugary foods are operating on the same neurological systems that other drugs of addiction operate on, and So those overlapping systems that create you to sort of seek out and sort of prefer and like and desire certain types of sweet foods are the same that are going on with other addiction systems. And the other part of that is that it's difficult to sort of inhibit or stop yourself from sort of over-consuming those highly palatable foods. So And we know that those systems in the brain that sort of help you stop yourself are impaired in addiction. And we are actually finding out that maybe some of those same systems are what is getting in the way of people stopping themselves from eating when they're not hungry, for example.
Can you use or have you tried the same sort of interventions, and are they as successful when the symptom is obesity, but what you suggest is perhaps the cause may be addiction?
Well, I don't think we're at the point where there's a sort of a recommended sort of similar type of treatment, but we do know that certain types of medications that are used for attention and impulse control, sort of Ritalin-based medications, have been used in obesity treatment programs with some moderate success. So, you know, there's sort of some work going on in that area.
Justin, what are the economic impacts overall? What does it cost society, obesity and even overweight?
In our research, we published a paper a couple of years ago and found that just medical costs alone could be as much as $147 billion per year that we could attribute to obese patients in the system.
And I know insurance companies and businesses have tried to address this, but it's kind of a thorny issue. It's a difficult issue to address directly.
It is a thorny issue. One tack that we can think about from a policy standpoint is if we could find some interventions that would pay for themselves, then employers might be willing to do this without a lot of effort from public health or government officials. The trick is, as you've heard, it's hard to find interventions that are successful at maintaining weight or losing weight in the long term. And it's also even harder to find interventions that you can do for low cost that work in the short term, because most tenure nowadays, employers probably don't expect their employees to be around 10 or 15 years from now. So it has to work pretty quickly.
But insurance companies have toyed with the idea of adjusting premium rates based on these risk factors. So smoking is one and obesity is another.
That's right. Insurance companies would love to be able to do that so that they're assigning the premiums to the places where the higher risk is. Under health reform, there's actually some initiatives to allow financial incentives from insurers and employers to participate in weight management programs at a work site. And as long as they're not tied to outcomes, people tend to be a little bit more accepting of the practice. But the idea would be give employees some incentive to get an additional incentive to get their weight under control.
Let's go back to the phones now. Alex is on the line from Raleigh. Hello, Alex.
Hello. How are you doing today, sir?
Good, good.
My question is, I've been listening to the program for about 30 minutes, and then I asked the gentleman, how much, when it comes down to the subject of obesity, how much of it is genetics? Because I look at, you got people like a LeBron James, who is like a 6'9", big guy, but how much of that is from the overeating side of it versus somebody, another child, they start off at the same level, and then that child is sprout out to be this tall, this big. And then you got, you know, some that'll end up at 5 feet tall. Because I'm the father of a 13-year-old that's already 6 feet tall. And just from normal, we have normal eating habits. We don't go to a lot of fast food places. And he's already at 200 pounds, but he's 13 and 6 feet tall. Compared to most people in his grade, he towers over them.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get an answer for that.
Sure.
Sarah,
I can
thank
take
you, Alex.
That one. Well, it sounds like watch out, LeBron, first of all. But, you know, the body mass index is only so good. Okay, so the BMI is an epidemiologic tool, meaning it's useful for large populations of people for screening how over time things are changing. When you try to apply it to any one individual person, then it's not going to be as useful or accurate. And the situation you're describing, the athletic teenage male, tends to be the one situation where it maybe not reflect health as accurately as it would in, say, a younger child. But I do have to say that under about the age of 9 or 10, the BMI is fairly accurate in reflecting health risks for an individual person, but it does tend to be less precise of a tool when you get to the older children.
And is BMI, or should it be, adjusted for race and culture? Does it matter?
Oh, it absolutely should be. We just don't know yet how to adjust it, but we know that there are differences among different ethnicities for sure.
Justin, what do we know about the differences?
As Sarah mentioned, the increase in obesity rates has been really across the board in the population, but there are still, you know, segments of the population, particularly low income and some racial minorities, where the prevalence is still much higher. And again, the debate about what those causes are is still ongoing. But in terms of economics, people are concerned about, especially you know, urban populations where access to healthy foods is just not there. They're known as food deserts, and focusing on areas like that where at least policy can potentially come in and make a difference.
On the State of Things today, we are talking about obesity, and I want to thank Justin and Bernard for being on the program today. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Justin Trogdon's a research economist at RTI International. Bernard Femler is an assistant professor of community and family medicine at Duke University. Just ahead on the program, we're going to talk with one of North Carolina's, an artist in North Carolina, about her satirical look at obesity. And we're still taking your phone calls at 877-962-9862. Stay with us on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. We're talking about obesity today. Sarah Armstrong is with us on the phone. She's a general pediatrician at the Duke Children's Healthy Lifestyles Program. Justin Trogdon is with us, a research economist at RTI. And joining us now in the studio is Rachel Herrick. Rachel is an artist who has created a satirical look at how our culture views the obese. Her project is called The Museum for Obese Conservation Studies. Rachel, welcome.
Thanks,
good to have
Frank.
You here.
I'm glad to be here.
Before we find out about the obese, we want to remind everybody that we are taking phone calls at 877-962-9862. Email address is sot@wnc.org. And the conversation now taking a turn to look at the stigma of obesity in our society. Rachel, what is an obese?
An obese is a fictitious genus of mammals that I've invented. The obese physically is me wearing a muumuu. I am both the male and the female, and I cover three species worth of obese: the northern obese, the southern obese, and the western obese.
And it's structured like kind of a National Geographic, you know, wildlife pick.
Yeah,
right?
It's contextualized within this museum called the Museum for Obese Conservation Studies, MOX. And so the museum coordinates research and conservation and education efforts to educate the public about the obese. It is an endangered animal. And so we need to do our part to conserve it.
Well, let's give us a sense of what it is. We've got a clip from one of the videos, two actors pretending to be researchers trying to examine an obese up close in the wild. Here's a clip of one of the researchers talking about the obese species.
I kind of liken them to skunks and coons because they, you know, they'll basically eat whatever is available. And that makes them not too popular with the locals. You know, they get into dumpsters and whatnot and just make a mess, tear up gardens. And I felt like the luckiest man in history. I mean, to be intimate with this creature that is so elusive. I mean, you know, that I've seen two of them in person is just spectacular. So hopefully we'll find a male this time. And hopefully the male won't be more aggressive.
That's a clip from the obese conservation video found at the website for the Museum for Obese Conservation Studies at obese.org. And Rachel Herrick is here, the producer of that film. So what made you want to do this?
You know, this project comes from an exasperation of sorts with being an obese person myself and seeing a lot of the anxiety and panic around this obesity epidemic and feeling at odds with the cultural portrayal of obese people as lazy or fat or lazy or stupid or unmotivated or things like that, and wanting to explore that discrepancy in my own life and, you know.
It really does. As you see the film, I mean, you understand, and it's a kind of an indictment on all of us, how we may view people who are obese as an alien species. That's exactly kind of what the film does. But as you listen to this program now, you've heard the first two-thirds of it, and we're talking about it in a more clinical way and hopefully a sensitive way, and yet there's a kind of sense of other in the way we're all talking. I mean, how do you hear the show we're doing right now?
You know, I think Sarah's brought up some really amazing points. There's a science to this, to obesity, that is completely relevant and interesting, but it also doesn't reflect the lived experience of obesity. And that's where my project comes in, I hope. For me personally, it's just trying to create or create a space for some dialogue to happen about our cultural perceptions of obesity.
And Sarah, you have dealt with this and you talked a little bit about it, particularly with children, the difficulty that they have in trying to manage what happens in the school and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's true in that there is sort of an overall lower quality of life for children who are living with obesity. But, you know, there also is the reality that that's not everybody. You know, some people are perfectly happy the way they are, and they're able to do the things that they want to do in life. And I think we need to not assume that people are suffering a lower quality of life because of their shape and size. And it's kind of the last frontier of bias, honestly, in my mind, is, you know, we struggled with the racial bias first, and then there was sort of the sexuality bias that, you know, our country's still facing a little bit. But weight bias is kind of this final frontier that I think is under-recognized, but very, very much prevalent.
How do you experience that, Rachel?
You know, Sarah's so right on there, and that's really interesting, and I'm glad to hear her put it like that. There's a relationship between the rhetoric of, again, you know, around fat stigma and the rhetoric 30 years ago around or against homosexuality. I do feel that way, and I live at odds with the stereotypes around fat people. I mean, speaking personally.
Well, when you just encounter a stranger, for instance, do you sense right away that they're making some kind of mental adjustments?
Absolutely. When I meet a new person, there's this delicate dance that happens where I can feel them underestimating me. And there's this unspoken 10-minute conversation within any conversation where I'm, you know, gently trying to show that I'm a competent human being, because there's this look, and it's not, you know, it's not everybody that does it, but I think in the arts I see it a lot, in my line of work, where I don't get taken as seriously on first glance.
Well, so we've talked about some of those. You talked about the stereotype being lazy, maybe not being as intelligent. Mm-hmm. How about the one that you're somehow suffering and that you are must be miserable?
Yeah. People really don't seem to be able to stand the idea that I might be a happy person. I think, and for me, that's why my art, the Museum for Obese Conservation Studies, it is funny, intentionally funny. I don't, you know, I'm not looking for pity or to perpetuate the anxiety the other way against, you know, fat stigma. I think it, you know, it reflects my happy life. And I think it's important.
And yet we've got this sort of interesting problem, Justin, let me ask you, you know, because we can talk about there are risk factors involved. There are definite correlations between some health issues. And so in that sense, we treat this as a problem. When we call it a problem, we use terms like epidemic, and it does have social cost. And yet there's this other side of it. It's not a problem for a lot of people.
Right. Well, actually, you know, most free market economists would tend to approach this as an individual decision in the sense that not so much to downplay the genetics, but if you're happy at the weight you're at, we wouldn't have much of an issue with it and there wouldn't be much cause for public policy. And so most economists tend to focus on people who maybe can't fully make that cost-benefit sort of calculation that we assume everyone is making. And so that's why you get attention on children, some attention to the addiction issue. You know, is there something about food that's interrupting the normal decision-making? But a lot of free market economists probably wouldn't disagree with too much about people being overweight and happy, and that's an optimal decision, as we would say.
And yet, because there are these correlations, they do have an impact on costs overall, and so then it becomes kind of a public policy question.
And I would just add that health is, I mean, happiness is one marker of a you know, a good life, but you know, it is also possible to be overweight and healthy. There are healthy fat people just as there are unhealthy thin people. You know, recently there's a lot of conversation about the health at every size movement, where you treat wholeness as an individualized set of markers, and it's possible.
Well, and Sarah, I would think that that might be even more important when you're talking about children, because it's not so clear how it's going to turn out. They're in the course of development. Stigmatizing them early or suggesting that they have something they've got to deal with early on can be another one of the problems, I guess, that you deal with.
Absolutely. I mean, we always try and approach it in terms of the choices that you can make, you know, despite that there's some choices you can't make, you know, the genes that you're born with, that you got to take those for the rest of your life. But you try and figure out what are the choices that you want to make for whatever it is you're trying to achieve in life. So for the boy that wants to be able to shoot a better three-point jumper, you know, then we want to make sure that he's physically active so he can have the strength to do that. So it's about sort of what you want to achieve in life. But I will say also, though, that I agree with health at every size, but I don't want to let that hinder our efforts to try and make the environment more healthy for children, to give them just the best possible chance that we can for a healthy future. Because we do know that above the 99th percentile, kids have a very high risk of having health problems. And, you know, we've treated over 5,000 children and their families in the Healthy Lifestyles Program, and these are great kids. I mean, they play baseball, they like math, they want to grow up and be doctors, and they're really facing, some of them, a life of visits in the hospital and taking medications starting at a young age. And, you know, in some senses, we're doing a lot to change the environment, but in other ways, I think we're still failing them, failing our children. You know, type 2 diabetes used to be called adult onset diabetes, and we changed the name because it started happening in children. Mm-hmm. And it was easier to change the name than it was for us to say, we need to change. We need to change our policies. We need to settle our political differences so that we can make this a healthier place for our kids to grow up.
I want to go back to the phones right now. Kathy is on the line from Mebane. Hello, Kathy.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing fine. I have two quick comments. One, I have a disabled relative that I help shop for, and simply by eliminating fast food and sugar soft drinks, I was able to help this individual lose 85 pounds over a period of about a year or so, which prevented him from getting diabetes, which he still doesn't have, although he takes medicine that has been clinically proven to cause diabetes.
Hmm.
So that's one. The second point I would like to make is that I feel that by eliminating all farm subsidies, such as the subsidies for corn, sugar, and even cotton, soybeans, all the other farm subsidies, we would be responding to two very serious problems that our government is now facing. The first problem is we all have heard in the news about the debt ceiling that needs to be raised, and each party is discussing how we can cut our budget. I feel like by completely eliminating all the farm subsidies, we would put our markets on a truly fair market system,
and
this would encourage manufacturers to eliminate or reduce the amount of sugar and corn and other fat in the diets of in the foods that they produce.
All right, Kathy. Well, I want to get actually a response to that, because we talked about that earlier. Thank you for your call. And I wonder if anybody has done the math on that, Justin. Do we have a sense of to what extent artificially low prices have meant that we have too much of this stuff in our diet?
The research that I'm familiar with has focused more on how changes in prices of the food items that are made with those products affect obesity rates. And in fact, just saw a new report from the USDA today about responsiveness of adolescent BMI to things like sugar sweetened beverage prices, and it is responsive. So the assumption is that if the food subsidies affect those prices that adolescents are facing, then you could see an impact on BMI.
So,
now, in terms of the research behind how much it would save the government, and some of the there are drawbacks to that. You don't want all food to become more expensive, because then you have real equity issues going on that would happen for low income households.
Yeah, but just imagine if you took the subsidies out of the fatty, sugary food and gave the money to people to buy good food. How about that?
My personal sort of gut reaction is that it does make sense. It is a very distorted market.
This is why I won't be elected.
I can't give you a research study.
Neither one of us are going to get into office anytime soon with logic like that. But this is kind of a moral and a public issue. And I want to ask Rachel if she's confronted this sense that people think about obesity in moral terms. It's kind of a moral issue for them.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, and there's a historical precedent to that. You know, I mean, it goes back farther than this, but, you know, we can look back to Freud and the Victorians.
Willpower.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's when they invented that.
Yeah, yeah. Transcending our carnal base urges to eat. The Victorian period published pamphlets encouraging especially women who were the weaker sex, according to them.
They could will themselves to more strength.
Yeah, avoid exciting foods like sugar, and fats. We don't want to get overstimulated. It's bad for us. It's animal-like. So thinness became indicative of a body in control of its animalistic urges. And then there's also all kinds of class things that get mixed up in the lower class having a more robust body due to a different diet than, you know. There is a moral component still perceived.
Sarah, how do you cope with, in your young patients, those young people who are struggling with the stigma?
Well, they face it from everywhere. I mean, they face it from their peers, first and foremost. They sometimes face it from siblings within the house who you might have two siblings, one who is overweight and one who's underweight, and we see plenty of those. And that's very difficult because then they often get defined by their weight, not by who they are or what they're good at. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what we try and focus on for kids, you know, for any kind of behavioral intervention for kids, no matter what you're talking about, is to focus on the strengths and try and expand those as much as you can to overcome those other areas so that you're defined more by the things you want to become and what you're good at than anything that's, you know, less in your control.
Rachel, what kind of response have you had to your exhibit and your film?
I'm pleased that it's probably 60% positive. And there's 40% that maybe doesn't share my sense of humor.
Are there people who feel that you're being cruel?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so.
I had that sense initially. I thought, ooh, I wonder how people are taking this.
Yeah. Well, because the museum, my name doesn't appear. You know, so it's not clear who is this obese character. It's not clear that it's me. It's not clear that I'm telling the joke with my own body. Interestingly, most people approaching the work for the first time assume that a man has made it. Maybe that has to do with the way that science is coded male. And I use a lot of those scientific tropes in my work. But approaching the work for the first time, it reads male and it reads mean.
Wow.
And,
you got the Randy Newman problem.
Yeah.
I want to thank you all for being on the program today. Rachel Herrick, an artist, created the satirical look at how our culture views the obese. It's called the Museum for Obese Conservation Studies. You can find it at obeasts.org. I want to thank Sarah Armstrong, general pediatrician at Duke Children's Healthy Lifestyles Program, and Justin Trogdon, a research economist at RTI. And thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.